Mrs. Cornish would have become more and more concerned about her daughter's involvement with Mr. Sackville. At an impressionable age, she herself had been taken advantage of by a man who refused to marry her and look after their baby, possibly an unscrupulous employer, and she was desperate for the same not to happen to her child. Becky Birtle returned to the parlour. Treddles had asked for her. He still had one last point he wanted to clear up. But one look at the girl's face let him know that she had heard everything. How? The floorboards would have squeaked had she snuck back to eavesdrop. As if she heard his question, she pointed behind his head. He turned around to see a small, half-open window. She had eavesdropped from outside.
"Mrs. Cornish can't be my mother," she said,
her voice barely above a whisper.
"She doesn't even like me."
"I can't speak to the state of her affection, but I have no doubt she feels a tremendous sense of responsibility toward you."
"Enough to kill Mr. Sackville, when he did nothing wrong? That can't be."
"If she was the one who poisoned Mr. Sackville, she wouldn't be the first to have attempted murder for what she perceived he did."
"But what could she even perceive?"
Treddles could not have asked for a better lead-in to his question. "Perhaps, unbeknownst to you, she witnessed the incident that caused Mr. Sackville to no longer be there everywhere you turned." Becky Birtle squinted at him.
"That's ridiculous."
"Is it? I can't tell, since I don't know what happened."
"Nothing happened. Nothing."
"It might not have been nothing to Mrs. Cornish." Becky Birtle threw up her hands.
"Fine. I'll tell you. It was a few days after Mr. Sackville and I had those horrible tummy troubles. I had my monthly, and it was an awful one. I could hardly stand. But Mrs. Cornish said it was no excuse. The other women in the house didn't take to their beds during their time. Mr. Sackville saw that I was in pain, and he was worried. He thought maybe it was something I ate. So I told him the truth, that it was only my monthly." Treddles could only hope he wouldn't stammer. His face scalded with embarrassment.
"That was it?"
"That was it. Mum, my real mum, not Mrs. Cornish, always told me that men hate it when women bring up their menses. I thought it was ridiculous. They love to moan about their own aches and pains. Why should they begrudge us a little complaining about ours? But Mum was right. That was the end of anything between Mr. Sackville and me."
The light dimmed in Becky Birtle's eyes.
"Guess he wasn't a real friend after all."
Charlotte twisted the black handkerchief with her black, kidskin-clad fingers and reminded herself that she must give the impression of frailty and forlornness. It would not do for her to swivel about, scanning the guests who moved through the lobby of Claridge's. The widow's veil might obscure her face, but it couldn't completely disguise the set of her shoulders or the angle of her head. She glanced discreetly toward the front entrance, followed it with a sideways glimpse toward the staircase. Perhaps now she should lift the handkerchief and give it a helpless flutter. Maybe even,
"My condolences on your loss, my dear lady."
Her heart thudded. Lord Ingram had materialized out of nowhere.
"What are you doing here?"
One corner of his lips lifted. Her heart thudded again. She couldn't remember the last time he smiled, or half-smiled, at her.
"And I thought you'd be glad to see me, since you're always scheming for it."
"Yes, when I've nothing better to do."
He sat down next to her on the chaise longue. The half-smile had disappeared, but no forbidding look took its place. How rare and incomprehensible! At the moment he was not actively displeased with her.
"With your penchant for diminishing a man to little more than a shell of his former manhood, it never ceases to amaze me that you managed to receive all the proposals you did."
She had indeed reaped her fair share, including one from his brother,
Lord Bancroft, her favourite proposal of them all.
"It's my décolletage. When gentlemen stare at my bosom, they don't hear a word I say. I strongly believe that if trees sprouted breasts tomorrow, they would soon be wearing wedding rings."
He chortled. Her nerves tingled.
"Some men had that effect on women," as Mrs. Watson declared. But it was Charlotte's obligation not to respond to said effect when she was in the middle of a surveillance mission, or at least not to respond to such a degree as to diminish her concentration. "So what are you doing here?"
He blew out a soft breath. "You are many things, Charlotte, but terribly experienced you aren't. It was almost too easy to predict that you'd be setting up shop at Claridge's to see what you can find out about your Mrs. Marbleton."
Had he come to put a stop to it, or... "Don't tell me you mean to keep me company."
"Easier than bailing you out of trouble later."
She wondered whether she ought to object to his presence. But he was right that she had no experience in this sort of thing. And if he was going to take the trouble to make sure she was all right, she'd rather he sit next to her than lurk somewhere unseen. She smoothed her gloves. "I won't be here for much longer. I have a client to meet."
"A less troublesome one, I hope."
"Don't be such a constant killjoy. If nothing else, my association with Mrs. Watson has already made us £5. And we've clients lined up for the next fortnight."
£5!
The thought never failed to make her giddy. But he would not let go of his entrenched cynicism.
"She has certainly been quick to exploit your acuity for her own gains."
She peered at him through her veil. "What's the matter, your lordship? Usually you are a bit more generous in your opinion of people, especially when you don't know enough about them."
"I can afford to be more generous when those hypothetical people aren't essentially in control of your life, Charlotte. I still think it would..."
But she was no longer listening to him.
"What is it?"
he asked softly, taking her by the hands, so that to passers-by they would appear deep in conversation, a bereaved young widow and a gallant friend trying to comfort her. "Do you see the man in the gold paisley waistcoat?" She indicated his location with a tilt of her head. "I know him." Lord Ingram glanced unobtrusively at the man.
"Who is he?"
"The first time I went to Mrs. Watson's place, before I arrived, she had let in another young woman thinking she was me. But that caller turned out to have fraud in mind, claiming kinship with Mrs. Watson where none existed."
"And?"
"And she had an accomplice, a young man."
Charlotte took one more look at Paisley Westcott.
"That one."
19.
By the time Inspector Treddles reached the closest police station to Curry House, Mrs. Cornish had already been brought in and put into an interrogation room. He wasted no time.
"Mrs. Cornish, you said nothing about the fact that Becky Birtle is your daughter."
Mrs. Cornish flinched, as if he'd thrown sand in her face.
That's... "I wouldn't try to deny it. Not when I already have confirmation from Mrs. Birtle."
Mrs. Cornish glanced at the door.
"I've dismissed the constable who stood guard outside," said Treddles. "I gave my word to Mrs. Birtle that as much as possible I would keep Becky's true parentage a secret."
Mrs. Cornish stared at her hands. She'd come to the police station in a pair of kid gloves, probably her best pair. "Surely you must understand why I couldn't possibly bring it up, Inspector. It took years of hard work to rise to where I am. After Mr. Sackville passed, Mrs. Struthers wrote me and said if the next tenant at Curry House didn't need a housekeeper, I was welcome to go work for her. But if word got out that I have an illegitimate child, she won't want me any more. No one will want me any more. Respectability is everything in my line of work."
The anxiety in her voice was overwhelming. "Then why bring her to your place of work at all?"
"Mrs. Birtle was worried that Becky was getting too headstrong and restless. The Birtles don't have much.
Becky would have to go into service. And service can be... it can be a small, closed life. I remember how bored I was as the under-housemaid, how little there was to look forward to. I never wanted to get into trouble, but a flirtation here and there was the only cure for boredom. And then I fell in love with the son of the house, and he promised to look after me. It's that same old story. But when it happened to me, I thought he was special and I was special. And it turned out that neither of us was special at all. I didn't want that to happen to Becky. Here I am in a position of some authority. I could look after her. But more than anything else, I felt Curry House was a safe place. Mr. Sackville never made any advances toward me or any other women in the house. And he treated Jenny Price with more care than most able-bodied folks did. Treadles pulled out a chair but did not sit down.
And then he proved himself not quite as above reproach as you had thought.
Mrs. Cornish's lips quivered.
You think...
You failed to inform Tommy Dunn of details of Mr. Sackville's condition that would have let a physician know that he was in need of strychnine. You said Becky requested to take the photograph when instead you stowed it among her things so that no one else would find out that she is your daughter and that you had a strong motive to protect her. Not to mention that you were, according to everyone else, desperately searching for a missing whiskey decanter.
"Are you implying there was arsenic in the whiskey?"
cried Mrs. Cornish, her gloved hands gripping the edge of the desk that separated them.
"Becky suffered a gastric attack the same day Mr. Sackville was forced to spend the night in Exeter. The only thing they both had was whiskey from the decanter."
"If there was arsenic in the whiskey, I didn't put it there. I might not have been completely truthful earlier, Inspector, but it was to save my position and my reputation, not my neck."
Her breaths echoed harshly in the small room. Treadles waited until she had regained a measure of her composure.
"Did Mr. Hodges tell you that Mr. Sackville offered Becky some of his whiskey?"
"He did, and said I ought to keep a closer eye on the girl. So I snuck by when Becky cleaned above stairs. Several times a day I did this, and never once did I see Mr. Sackville with her. I kept it up until the day before Mr. Sackville died. What reason did I have to poison Mr. Sackville when I'd no evidence that he took advantage of Becky or even thought about it?"
"Then why were you scrambling for the whiskey decanter, going so far as to snoop in Tommy Dunn's quarters for it?"
"I didn't want to believe that Becky took it."
She looked at him beseechingly.
"I didn't want to believe that my own flesh and blood was a thief."
"Why did you secret the photograph in her luggage, then?"
"Before Becky came, I was afraid I'd never want her to leave again. But she came and... she was a stranger. She thought a little too well of herself. She didn't like to work too hard. And she didn't care a whit for life in service, except that she was in the household of a real gentleman."
Mrs. Cornish sighed.
"I remember the housekeeper at my first place scolding the maids, and I remember thinking how unsympathetic and needlessly strict she was. But I've become that woman. I can't understand why Becky doesn't take greater pride in her work, and I can't understand why dust on the mantle doesn't feel like dust in the eyes to her. She was a disappointing housemaid to me, and I must have been an ogre of a housekeeper to her. But I wanted her to have the photograph. I didn't offer it to her, because I thought she'd find that offer strange. But I figured that if she had it, she'd keep it. And maybe someday, when she's a good deal older herself, she'll look back and understand that I wasn't being unreasonable, but responsible."
A knock came on the door, startling her. She looked fearfully at Treadles. Treadles rose.
"If you'll excuse me."
On the other side of the door was Constable Perkins.
"Sir, the results from the chemical analyst."
Treadles took the cable and swore. The whiskey he'd retrieved from Becky Birtle contained no trace of arsenic, nor any trace of chloral.
"I also have a message on the Wheatstone machine from Sergeant MacDonald,"
said the young constable.
Dear Inspector Treddles, dozens showed up at Scotland Yard to testify to Mr. Sackville's movements in London, the hazards of soliciting help in the paper. One man seems credible. According to him, Mr. Sackville regularly visited the house across the street from his in Lambeth, usually shortly before dinner. He remarked Mr. Sackville because he was a fine-looking gentleman and didn't seem to belong to the district. The most interesting thing he said, however, was that the house burned down some 6 weeks ago, which fits nicely with the occasion of Mr. Sackville's final trip to London, the one from which he returned early and distraught. To be thorough, I showed the man a picture of the staff at Curry House. To my surprise, he immediately identified Hodges the valet. I asked if Hodges ever accompanied Mr. Sackville. He said not that he'd ever seen, but he remembered Hodges because once Hodges knocked on his door and asked if he knew what went on in the house Mr. Sackville visited. I will interview others in the neighbourhood to see if they have seen either Mr. Sackville or Hodges. MacDonald.
Clandestine entry into a suite of rooms at Claridge's should be a straightforward affair. One bribed a porter or two and proceeded. Apparently not, especially if one's debut in breaking and entering was to take place under Lord Ingram's watchful eyes. There was a protocol, which consisted of handing the matter over to Lord Bancroft Ashburton, Lord Ingram's second eldest brother and Charlotte's one-time suitor, a man of many responsibilities and almost as many means of achieving his ends, and waiting until Lord Bancroft issued a suitable time for the burglary to take place. "It takes the fun out of the thing, to have approval from high places," Charlotte complained to Lord Ingram, as they walked into Mrs. Marbleton's large, empty suite. "This ought to feel more illegal." Instead, they'd been given a perfectly safe window of 3/4 of an hour from the man who defended the Empire against threats from without and within. Lord Ingram only shook his head. "I don't mean to sound ungrateful," Charlotte said, feeling a little apologetic. "You called in a favour, I take it?" In spite of his brother's assurance that no Marbleton would return during the allotted 45 minutes, Lord Ingram approached a window and peered down to the street.
"It's the only currency Bancroft understands."
"You can't possibly have that many favours left to call in." Charlotte knew something of this trade between brothers. A faint regret tinged his answer.
"Used my last."
From time to time he would leave England for a while, ostensibly for a dig. But Charlotte could always tell whether he'd been to an excavation and when he'd been somewhere else entirely. Archaeology, as it turned out, was an excellent excuse for all kinds of foreign jaunts. Once he returned on a crutch and attributed his injury to a large statue falling over. Another time he came back with a heavily bandaged hand and said that there had been feral dogs at the site. The scar on his hand hadn't remotely resembled the marks of canine teeth or claws. "Does your wife never have any suspicions?" she'd asked him once.
"No."
To have suspicions, one would have to pay attention. After their falling out, Lady Ingram had not bothered with any more false affections. "There must be ways to find temporary escape without risking your life," Charlotte had told him.
"You have fewer choices, Charlotte," he'd answered. "It doesn't mean I have many."
She let her gaze linger on him another second, then ventured farther inside the suite, carefully opening drawers, wardrobes, steamer trunks. When she'd taken a mental inventory of everything, she went back to a cupboard that housed a portable darkroom, several cameras, and a large stack of photographs. Mrs. Marbleton did not stay alone. Also registered to the suite were two young people, Stephen and Frances Marbleton, her children, ostensibly,
with Frances Marbleton being none other than Miss Ellie Hartford from The Dog and Duck in Bywater, the woman who had wanted to claim Mrs. Watson as her mother. And judging by the photographs, the young Marbletons had been travelling. Many of the pictures featured only scenery, but some had captured one of the young Marbletons in the frame. They were probably travelling alone, taking each other's pictures. In those images, they seemed to have deliberately chosen not to include any landmarks. There was the sea, and there was open landscape, but the coast could have been any stretch of British headland, and the rolling countryside was as likely to have been plucked from Sussex as Derbyshire.
"If you can afford to live at Claridge's Hotel," called Lord Ingram from the next room, "would you still seek employment?"
He'd found a list of employment agencies.
"I believe they specialize in helping women, don't they?"
Charlotte sucked in a breath. On the list was Miss Oswald's employment agency, where Miss Oswald had all but accused Charlotte of being a journalist going about trying to write an expose on similar agencies. Briefly, she recounted that conversation to Lord Ingram. "I wonder whether Frances Marbleton went around to all these fine establishments, and what she might have been doing there."
"Since they have a portable darkroom, they must have photo negatives. I can make prints of her images and find out."
"You do that, dear sir. I'm afraid I must go and prepare for my next client," says Charlotte.
"A client you need to prepare for?"
"Oh, yes. At least an hour of preparation."
He rolled his eyes. "You are up to no good, Charlotte Holmes."
"You should try it sometimes. Or more precisely, you should return to it sometimes. You used to be excellent at being up to no good, your lordship."
He did not rise to her goading, but asked, "Why did you ask me to wait for you on a street corner last night? And why did you look back several times after I got in the hackney? Are you again suspecting that you might be followed?"
"I was being followed. I changed vehicles 3 times before I could be sure I'd shaken my tail loose."
"You think it's the Marbletons?"
"I'd much rather it be someone you hired. Why would the Marbletons follow me?"
"Why did Mrs. Marbleton counterfeit a case for you to begin with? It isn't safe, this Sherlock Holmes business."
"Well, this next client is definitely safe," she promised him. "Sherlock Holmes would give up the business altogether if this one proves anything but safe."
A subdued Roger Shrewsbury walked into Sherlock Holmes's parlour.
In advance of his visit, a hole had been drilled in the wall between the parlour and the bedroom, then concealed in such a way as to allow Charlotte to see into the parlour without herself being seen. But all that had been completed the day before, with help from a friend of Mrs. Watson's who invented magic tricks. The 1 hour's preparation Charlotte mentioned to Lord Ingram involved no further work on the flat, only further work on Mrs. Watson, begging her to not be too hard on Roger Shrewsbury. Mrs. Watson took on the role of Holmes's sister. She briskly explained to the client the infelicities of the great detective's health and the necessity for her to act as a go-between. Then, without asking Shrewsbury whether he needed to be reassured Holmes still had all his faculties, she said,
"I can see that you have rarely been a man of your own mind, sir. You are surrounded by those accustomed to imposing their will on you, and you have been content to let them make your decisions. This, then, is quite a leap for you."
"Yes," came Shrewsbury's hesitant words. "Yes, I suppose."
"You mentioned nothing of what you wished to see Sherlock about, but he has hazarded that it has something to do with the circumstances surrounding your mother's death." Mrs. Watson smiled. "It couldn't have been an easy decision to trust a stranger. My brother commends you for it."
Her smile was so warm and encouraging, Charlotte would never have guessed that she had been adamantly against speaking any kind words to their caller.
"No, Sherlock Holmes ought to give him hell, expose him for the spineless cad he is."
The man probably believed for at least 48 hours that his conduct had been directly responsible for his mother's death,
Charlotte had explained.
He's useless, not heartless. Not to mention we don't want him to run out in mortification.
I'm beyond gratified by Mr. Holmes's understanding, said Shrewsbury, sounding almost teary.
Charlotte sighed. The poor man, so unaccustomed to receiving a bit of compassion.
He's right. I've indeed come about my mother, Shrewsbury continued. When Mr. Holmes's letter came about linking her death with Lady Amelia's and Mr. Sackville's, everyone in the family was furious. But I couldn't help wonder whether there wasn't some truth to it, some nefarious conspiracy at work, if you will. My mother had the constitution of a camel. She could hike 15 miles in the country, summer or winter. She never suffered from any aches or pains. And her physician, 20 years her junior, always said that her heart would keep on ticking long after his had given out.
So you agree with Sherlock's assessment that hers hadn't been a natural death?
I haven't told anyone this. But the night before we found her dead, she went out. Now you must understand that it had been an awful evening. Nobody said anything at dinner. My wife was terribly upset because my mother scolded her for failing at her duties to keep me on the straight and narrow. I hadn't received any lecture myself, but I was on pins and needles. It would be only a matter of time before mine crashed over me like an avalanche. As soon as dinner ended, my wife retired for the evening. I hovered around my mother for a while until she told me to go away. She'd deal with me the next day. It was oppressive at home, so I went out for a walk. And as I was coming back, I saw the most amazing sight. My mother, getting inside a hansom cab. A hansom cab? She'd never used a public conveyance in her life. She used to say that they smelled of unhygienic drunks, and that she shuddered to think about the encrusted grime and filth. I couldn't imagine what would have prompted her to get into a hansom cab when she was in town, with her own carriage parked in the mews behind the house, a quick summons away.
Did you ever ask?
No. Even if she hadn't died, I wouldn't have dared. She was the one who asked the questions and pointed out where we fell short, not the other way around.
He was silent for a few seconds.
That was the last I saw her. I returned home and proceeded directly to the whiskey bottle. I didn't even hear Miss Livia Holmes and Mother having a row outside. The next thing I knew was my wife shaking me, trying to make me understand that Mother was no more.
He clasped his hands together, as if trying to hold on to his courage.
Since then I've been trying to find out where she'd gone that evening and whom she'd seen, if anyone. So far I've managed to eliminate a few of her closest friends, but I always knew it couldn't possibly have been them in the first place. She'd call on them in sackcloth before she would in a hansom cab.
Sherlock believes you would like for us to pass on this information to Scotland Yard, without revealing the source, of course. Is he correct?
Shrewsbury grimaced.
Mother would be turning over in her grave if she knew what I was doing. But I don't want to accept that she died of an aneurysm of the brain. I don't want to accept that I was the one who sent her to her grave.
Mrs. Watson smiled again. You have done very well to bring the matter to Sherlock's attention.
Will it help solve what happened to my mother?
Let me confer with Sherlock first.
Charlotte already had her questions written down in a notebook.
See, she mouthed to Mrs. Watson. He's not so bad.
To which Mrs. Watson responded with a dramatic roll of her eyes, before taking the notebook and returning to the parlour.
Sherlock has a few questions. First, Mr. Shrewsbury, where exactly did you see Lady Shrewsbury get on the hansom cab?
Near the corner of George Street and Bryanston Square.
And which way did it go?
Toward the east.
Did you watch it for some time? Did it turn onto any other street?
It kept going for a while, and then it turned south, I think that was at Montague Street.
After he left, with a full slate of compliments for Mr. Holmes, Charlotte emerged from the bedroom, poured a cup of tea, and helped herself to a slice of the cake that he didn't touch. Mrs. Watson stood by the window, looking at Charlotte one moment, out of the window the next, then again at Charlotte, peacefully enjoying her cake.
"You're awfully unsentimental, Miss Holmes, about the man who was your first."
"It was a purely strategic decision." Charlotte took another bite. "I like him, but not enough to stand at the window and watch him leave."
Mrs. Watson sighed. "Young ladies these days. But I must admit he isn't as despicable as I thought he would be."
"He isn't despicable at all," Charlotte said. "His misfortune is that he was born fun-loving into a tribe that doesn't understand fun. They require him to be serious and ambitious, to have a lofty reputation, an enviable family, and an illustrious career in politics of all things. He's never been allowed to decide anything for himself, and therefore has never developed either confidence or judgment. So it really was remarkable that he would go against the will of his entire clan to tell us what he knows."
"But does it help, what he has told us?"
Charlotte looked longingly at the rest of the cake on the plate. Alas, she was already at 1.4 chins and must refrain from a second slice. "We now know that something extraordinary took place the night before Lady Shrewsbury died. We only need to find out what it was." 20.
Hodges, when he'd been brought into the interrogation room Mrs. Cornish recently vacated, betrayed no hint of anxiety. He nodded pleasantly at Treddles.
"Evening, Inspector. Constable Perkins says you have some questions for me."
Treddles regarded him for some time without speaking, a tactic meant to intimidate. From time to time, suspects broke down under the weight of his gaze. Often they fidgeted in discomfort, eyes darting everywhere. But occasionally, a suspect would stare right back at him with defiance, or even more rarely, with a great display of equanimity. Hodges fell into this last category. He met Treddles's gaze with a calm fearlessness that early Christian martyrs would have prayed for. But tranquility before an interrogator did not necessarily imply innocence. It could just as well indicate an arrogance bordering on pathology, or a complete lack of conscience. Treddles tapped his knuckles against the cable from Scotland Yard.
"Mr. Hodges, you said you didn't know where your late employer went in London or what he did. But now we have a reliable eyewitness who placed you at exactly the same place as Mr. Sackville, asking for his purpose. How do you explain that?"
"Fairly simple," said Hodges, as if he'd long expected the question and had the answer ready. "I was a boxer before I entered service, and lived in London for 20 years. Sometimes, when Mr. Sackville went off to London, I did too, to see old friends in the area. One day I saw him in Lambeth, and I was curious. Wouldn't anyone be under the circumstances? So I knocked on a few doors and asked if anyone knew what went on in the house Mr. Sackville entered. Nobody was sure, but they all thought it a little dodgy. Gambling, most likely. Probably loose women, too. I was frankly disappointed. It was too common. I thought Mr. Sackville would have had some more gentlemanly vices." Treddles didn't believe him. "If they truly were such pedestrian sins, why did you keep them a secret?" "Mr. Sackville can't defend his good name any more, so it's up to the rest of us. Men have sinned much worse. But when they die of natural causes, nobody cares what they've done in their spare time. Mr. Sackville ought to be given the same privacy. He'd have wanted it."
Treddles raised a brow.
You didn't have as high a regard for his good name. When you insinuated to Mrs. Cornish that he might be taking advantage of Becky Birtle.
I said no such thing.
For the first time, a note of vexation crept into Hodges's voice. I warned Mrs. Cornish that the girl was taking liberties with Mr. Sackville's expensive liquor, and made up the nonsense about Mr. Sackville offering it to her. Told Mrs. Cornish she ought to have a stern word with Becky. Even an amiable gentleman wouldn't hesitate to give the sack when his whiskey is endangered.
A former boxer, a man accustomed to dodging and counter-punching, and conditioned by years in the ring to keep a cool head under pressure.
What else have you been keeping from us, Mr. Hodges?
Nothing, Inspector, said Hodges evenly. Nothing.
Very well, Mr. Hodges. I will need a written statement of your whereabouts during the 24 hours leading to Mr. Sackville's death.
Hodges inclined his head.
And you'll have it, Inspector.
Hodges was not the only liar. Lady Sheridan's story, too, turned out to be less than entirely truthful. The YWCA had indeed dedicated a new centre, and Lady Sheridan had indeed been there, rather unexpectedly, as she had cabled her regrets only 2 days prior, citing ill health. But she had not left Bath the next morning, as she'd informed Inspector Treddles. Instead, she had departed immediately after the evening reception, even though she had paid for a night's lodging at the hotel.
"How do you explain the discrepancies, Lady Sheridan?" Treddles demanded.
He was tired. He'd returned to London on the early train, but more than that, he was frustrated. The investigation had uncovered an abundance of information that seemed promising, only to then never lead anywhere. He wanted a suspect. He wanted proper answers. He wanted the case solved so he could sleep in his own bed and wake up with his wife in his arms. Lady Sheridan, however, displayed no inclination to help him achieve his objectives.
"What does it matter when I left Bath, Inspector? An old woman is entitled to change her mind and head home earlier."
She was even thinner than Treddles remembered, her voice scratchy and weary. He felt an onslaught of self-reproach. She was clearly not well, and he'd fallen barely short of discourtesy.
"You had every right to modify your plans, ma'am. It is not that you changed your mind that brought me back, but that you failed to disclose the truth."
Lady Sheridan sighed. Treddles had the strange sensation that her skeleton might rattle apart, even with such a minuscule motion.
"The truth is, I had nothing to do with Mr. Sackville's death."
"Then, ma'am, you can have no objection to making your itinerary known, to remove yourself from suspicion." Lady Sheridan regarded him with something close to approval.
"Very well, then. I left Bath that evening, but had a spot of discomfort along my return route. I got off at the next stop, took a room at the nearest railway inn, and continued my journey the next day when I felt more equal to the challenge."
"Can anyone at the inn corroborate your account?"
"I'm afraid I didn't pay much attention to where I was. All I needed was a bed that didn't sway. It could have been any inn at any station along the line."
It took a great deal of cheek to give such an answer, and a great deal of dignity to endow it with even a semblance of seriousness.
"Ma'am, I'm afraid I can't take that for an answer. Why wasn't your maid with you?" "When I decided to leave Bath, she wasn't feeling well. I told her she could follow the next day, but of course en route I succumbed to the same thing."
Treddles studied this frail yet formidable woman, and asked her the same question he'd asked Hodges.
What else have you been keeping from us, Lady Sheridan? The answer he received was also the exact same.
Nothing, Inspector. Nothing.
Treddles did not neglect the servants of Lord and Lady Sheridan's household, but her maid unhesitatingly confirmed that she had stayed overnight in Bath by herself, and none of the others could tell him anything more of Lady Sheridan's precise itinerary. The majority had never even heard of Mr. Sackville. Only the two senior-most staff recalled the days when Mr. Sackville had been a frequent and esteemed guest.
"He'd bring friends. The friends would bring their friends," said Mrs. Gomer, the housekeeper. "I used to complain about how much more work it was when he came around. But then he didn't come around any more, and it was never the same. A house without young people is just not the same."
"I was still a footman in those days," said Mr. Addison, the butler. "A very young footman."
They stood in the butler's pantry, a small space allotted to Mr. Addison's use, as he cleaned the tap meant to sit on top of a gasogene.
"Everybody looked forward to Mr. Sackville's visits," Mr. Addison continued, "especially Miss Clara. He was more a big brother to her than an uncle. And, of course, her friends visited. Her cousins, too. It was a lively place then, the place in the country."
"Mr. Sackville was well-liked?"
"Oh, yes."
"Did he have any vices that you know of?" Mr. Addison was filling the lower globe of the gasogene with water. He paused for a moment.
"Not me, Inspector. He didn't drink too much or gamble too much, never made unreasonable demands on the staff, never took advantage of us, if you know what I mean."
Treddles nodded. He did know what Mr. Addison meant.
"Would you happen to know why Lord Sheridan and Mr. Sackville fell out?"
Mr. Addison did not answer immediately, but concentrated on tapping scoops of white powder through a small funnel into the gasogene's upper globe.
"Inspector, I ought not to say anything about it, but I'll tell you because you're looking for Mr. Sackville's murderer in the wrong place. Please do. I'll be more than delighted to eliminate your master and mistress from the list of suspects."
Mr. Addison peered at Treddles. When he was satisfied that Treddles had spoken in complete sincerity, he set aside the funnel.
"The last time Mr. Sackville came to visit, I overheard an argument between the brothers. You probably know that Mr. Sackville was a great deal wealthier than his lordship. Well, Mr. Sackville's advisers encouraged him to make certain investments. He passed on the suggestions to Lord Sheridan. The investments turned out badly. Mr. Sackville insisted on compensating his lordship for his losses, and his lordship wouldn't have it. Said nobody forced him to put money in any ventures, and he deuced well could take his losses on the chin like a man. But Mr. Sackville wouldn't let it rest. He went on insisting until his lordship exploded and told Mr. Sackville that Mr. Sackville understood the world only through the lens of his fortune. So his lordship was now poor as a church mouse, but what did it matter when his only child was dead and nothing would bring her back? Why couldn't Mr. Sackville at least let him have his pride?"
So Lady Sheridan had not been lying when she'd characterized the spat as an argument about manly honour. Mr. Addison carefully fitted the long-tubed tap on top of the gasogene and shook the entire apparatus for the powders, tartaric acid and bicarbonate of soda, if Treddles remembered correctly, to react with water. The contents of the gasogene bubbled, hissing faintly.
"Mr. Sackville left that day itself. I always felt bad about their estrangement. It wasn't really any kind of insurmountable dispute, but Mr. Sackville never came back. and I guess he had the last word after all when he left his fortune to his lordship.
Sometimes, the more you know, the less things make sense, Treddles's father-in-law had once said. If it had been the other way around, if Lord Sheridan had insisted Mr. Sackville compensate him for soured investments, and Mr. Sackville had refused, then the Sheridans would have been much more likely to hold a grudge all these years, a grudge that could have turned cancerous. But why would anyone kill a man who wanted to make it up to them, even though, strictly speaking, he hadn't been at fault, and had suffered his own losses?
I think Lord Sheridan always expected that Mr. Sackville would come striding back some day, and it would be as if there had never been a quarrel, said Mr. Addison, setting the gasogene aside for the gas to percolate into the water. A shame that didn't happen, and won't ever happen now.
Treddles thanked the butler, and then out of personal curiosity he said, I rather like that gadget, the gasogene. But the missus won't allow one. She says too many of them explode, and she has no desire to be married to a one-eyed policeman.
Mr. Addison chuckled. Well, gasogenes don't come wrapped in wicker for nothing. They will explode if they aren't handled carefully. That's why I make the soda water myself, instead of giving the task to a footman.
The gasogene didn't look as if it would hold more than 2 quarts of water, and it needed to sit for a considerable amount of time to complete the carbonation.
I can see that it makes enough for a small family, but what about when you have guests?
We have another one, and we can always store water that's been carbonated in bottles for a short while. But you are right. This wouldn't have been enough in the old days. When we used to have a house full of guests, we had gas delivered in canisters. But then again, canisters have their dangers too. Any gas under pressure does.
Very true.
Treddles glanced at the gasogene again, still tempted. Perhaps Alice might relent if he could find a way to further reinforce those gas globes.
And if you don't mind, one last question from me, Mr. Addison. Do you have any theories as to why anyone would wish Mr. Sackville harm?
The butler shook his head.
It's been decades since any of us last saw him. He could have met all kinds of unsavoury characters in those intervening years. All I can tell you is that his death has nothing to do with anyone in this house.
A knock came on the door of Lord Ingram's dark room.
My lord, said a footman. Mr. Shrewsbury to see you. Are you at home to him?
That ass.
You may show him in here.
Shrewsbury knew enough to enter quickly, closing the door behind himself.
Oh, good. This place doesn't stink as badly as I'd have expected.
It's ventilated, Lord Ingram said coolly as he pinned another photograph to a cord strung across the width of the room. What can I do for you, Mr. Shrewsbury?
Ah, you wouldn't happen to have heard from Miss Holmes, would you, my lord? The rumours are growing wilder every day, and I'm beginning to really worry about her.
Only beginning to?
Well, I thought she'd have come to me by now.
That foolish woman. What good reason could she possibly have for not seeking your aid?
In the crimson glow of the small red glass-encased light bulb, it was impossible to tell whether Shrewsbury flushed, but the scrape of his heels across the floor was quite audible. He cleared his throat.
I'm also beginning to see that maybe she might not want to be my mistress. If you hear from her, will you please tell her that I'm offering help, plain and simple, whatever she needs, and no conditions attached? I only want to make sure she's all... Wait, who's that?
Lord Ingram followed the direction of Shrewsbury's gaze. The prince had come out well. Despite the dim reddish light, Stephen Marbleton's features stood out in relief.
I don't know. I'm developing someone else's negatives. Have you seen the man before?
The man? No, never seen the man. But the woman looks familiar, even though I'm certain we've never been introduced.
Lord Ingram unpinned a print of Francis Marbleton taken at some seashore and handed it to Shrewsbury so he could take a closer look.
Have you gone tramping over the summer? Perhaps you passed her in some field.
No, I haven't been anywhere near Devon this summer.
The hairs on the back of Lord Ingram's neck rose. He exhaled carefully so he could continue to speak with some semblance of detachment.
This is Devon.
There must be pebble beaches elsewhere in Britain, but this looks a good deal like the one at Westward Ho. What a name, eh? Exclamation supplied. Went there with my mates a few times when I was at university. You've a house somewhere in the vicinity, don't you?
My place is near the Hangman Cliffs. Never been to Westward Ho.
I know what you mean. Too many tourists. I mean, it's the only reason the place exists in the first place.
Lord Ingram was suddenly in a hurry.
Anything else I can do for you, Mr. Shrewsbury?
No.
In that case, please excuse me. I have an urgent appointment.
Inspector Treadles was not proud of himself, but at some point his curiosity got the better of him, and he decided to burgle 18 Upper Baker Street. It wasn't terribly late yet, but from where he stood in the alley behind the house, number 18 was completely dark, not a fleck of light coming from behind the curtains. He had already circled the block of buildings twice. Now he slipped into the shadows of the back door and quickly picked the lock. The ground floor was silent, the caretaker's room furnished but empty of occupants. The stairs did not creak as he climbed up, nor did the stair landing groan. He was not surprised when the door of the parlour opened quietly at his touch. Why should it be locked, when most likely no one lived on these premises? Still, his heart pounded a little as he tiptoed to the bedroom. He pulled on a curtain. Light from the street lamp streamed inside, illuminating a perfectly made and perfectly empty bed. He shut the curtain and lit a match. No, nothing else that a perennially bedridden man would need. Was there even a chamber pot under the... A heavily bearded man stared back at him from under the bed and yanked Treadles by the ankles. Treadles went down hard. The man scrambled out and ran, stepping over one of Treadles's hands, causing him to yowl in pain. Fortunately, nothing was broken, but by the time Treadles made his way down the stairs and out the back door, the man had disappeared.
"Don't make any sounds."
Charlotte's heart jumped to her throat before she realized the voice, though kept to a vehement whisper, belonged to Lord Ingram. "What are you doing here? And don't make the joke that I should be overjoyed to finally have you in my bedroom." She'd been out of her room only a few minutes, getting ready for bed. He was the last thing she expected to find upon her return.
"Why should I joke about how overjoyed you must be?"
"There is a tear near the knee of your right trouser leg. Bits of grass and leaves are stuck to the edges of your shoes. And what's..." She grabbed her magnifying glass and studied his jacket, and then she knelt down to examine the wool of his trousers with the same rigour.
"You always did tell me you had perverse predilections," he murmured.
"I've never told you any such thing, and I have lost all respect for you, since you think my merely being on my knees in front of you is perverse." She pulled a pair of forceps out of a pen holder and removed several small gleaming objects that had been embedded in the fabric near his cuff and dropped them onto a table. "I see you have been to Claridge's again." The bits of glass weren't ordinary shards, but fragments of photographic plates. "There was some sort of struggle, plates shattering all over the place. And then you ran. I assume you made your way out from a service door to avoid being recognized running through the lobby, but you were pursued.
You leaped over a gate into Grosvenor Square Park. Did your trousers get caught on a finial of the gate? No, that's not it. I see what must have happened. You looked back as you ran and tripped over a root, but eventually you shook loose your pursuer and came here. You do know, I hope, that I'm the youngest child at home and have no idea how to dress a skinned knee for anybody.
Of course I know that. I came not to get a bandage, but to sleep with you since I almost died tonight.
She blinked. Was that her brain melting from a surge of extreme internal heat? He laughed softly. She rolled her eyes. Very funny. So you came to warn me that they knew the plates had been stolen and were lying in wait for you?
Roger Shrewsbury called on me earlier. I happened to be in the dark room. He saw the photographs I was developing.
Lord Ingram took out one from an inside pocket and handed it to Charlotte,
and said he thought the Pebble Ridge was near Westwood Ho, which isn't at all far from Mr. Sackville's house.
Didn't one of Inspector Treddles's reports state that a photographer and his assistant had come through the nearest village to Curry House in the week before Mr. Sackville's death? If those two were Stephen and Francis Marbleton, then...
Charlotte set aside her magnifying glass and forceps.
Now I know why Mrs. Marbleton came to see me. Sherlock Holmes interfered with her otherwise perfectly orchestrated plans. If I hadn't written that letter, there would have been no scrutiny of Mr. Sackville's death, and certainly nothing linking his death to the other two.
There is still nothing linking those three deaths, other than that they knew each other in life.
There's something else now. There's Sophia Lonsdale,
who is dead.
Charlotte tapped her finger against her lips. Unless she isn't.
Inspector Treddles lost count of the number of times he'd paced the street before Lord Ingram's townhouse. He was about to give up and leave when a hansom cab disgorged his lordship, who seemed not at all surprised to find Treddles loitering, and immediately invited him for a stroll. Treddles gave a quick account of what happened at 18 Upper Baker Street. He braced himself for mortifying questions as to why in the world he had chosen to break into the home of an acquaintance, but Lord Ingram only nodded.
If you'll permit me a few minutes, Inspector, you might find that what took place tonight on Upper Baker Street has some bearing on Mr. Sackville's case.
At first, his narrative of Sherlock Holmes's mysterious client only baffled Treddles. But when Lord Ingram reached the part where Francis Marbleton was identified to have been in Westwood Ho, Treddles stopped in his tracks.
The photographer and his assistant, the two young people who had come through the village 5 days before. I'll bet they were the ones who swapped out the strychnine in the doctor's dispensaries.
That is Holmes's and my thinking also. And Stephen Marbleton broke into 18 Upper Baker Street in an attempt to retrieve the photo negatives they found missing.
That part makes sense. But what does Mrs. Marbleton, who may or may not be Sophia Lonsdale, risen from death, have to do with anyone in this case?
We are still trying to find out. Will you meet with us tomorrow afternoon at 2?
Yes, of course.
Lord Ingram took out one of his cards and scrawled something on the back.
This is the address. I hope to know more by then.
When Treddles at last reached home, his wife was already in bed.
Welcome back, Inspector, she murmured as he slipped under the covers next to her. Busy night?
He exhaled.
I'll tell you in the morning.
Everything all right?
Asked Alice, wrapping an arm around him.
I think so.
1,001 questions swarmed in his head. His kingdom for a few absolute certainties. But he did arrive at one definite answer. Nobody in Sherlock Holmes's condition ought to be moved about willy-nilly. If he wasn't there in his bed at night,
then he most likely hadn't been there during the day. Treddles knew something of the circumstances of Lady Shrewsbury's death. He knew about Miss Olivia Holmes, who had in a drunken rage called for